This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. For over a decade, the IBM Center for the Business of Government has sought to connect research to practice, sponsoring third-party research on a broad range of public management issues facing us today. The Obama administration's widely publicized Open Government Initiative has generated a great deal of buzz among federal agency managers, as well as the public, especially as it relates to the use of online tools to extend active engagement beyond the traditional bounds of public hearings and comments on draft regulations. While all federal agencies have developed open government plans, many managers find themselves unfamiliar with what tactics and tools work best under different scenarios. What are the most common scenarios in which public managers seek to engage the public? What are the best online tools to engage and be engaged by the public? How can public managers identify tactics and online tools that make the most sense for given circumstances? And what are some of the key challenges facing public managers in this area? Today, we will pull back the veil on how online engagement tactics and tools can be used and when they work best with Matt Leininger, author of the IBM Center report, Using Online Tools to Engage and Be Engaged by the Public. Welcome, Matt. It's good to have you on the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Matt, social media has made it easier for citizens to engage their representatives. Faced with this new citizen capacity and expectation, government leaders have realized the need to be more proactive in their approach to the public. Given this new reality, what prompted your research in this area? And would you tell us a little bit more about how you conducted research for this report?
Well, I've been in this field of public engagement for pretty much my whole kind of adult career, but mainly on the face-to-face side of it. And of course, if you go back, this work really kind of blossoming in public engagement starting in the early to mid-90s, a whole lot of new face-to-face kinds of processes for getting people involved in public decision-making and problem-solving. And then, of course, along the way, the internet and social media in particular have just blossomed to the extent now that you really can't do this work without kind of using both online and face-to-face elements. That's really the best way to kind of tap the full potential of engagement. And so I started from the standpoint of a practitioner in face-to-face processes, learning more about the online ways of doing it and how to kind of try to weave the two kinds of things together.
Matt, I'd like to learn a little bit more about yourself. Could you tell us a little bit about your career and what your interests are?
Well, I first got interested in this kind of thing when I was an undergrad. I was interested in democratic history and theory, and I was lucky enough when I was in grad school and public administration school to get hired by a nonprofit organization that actually does it. At the time, it was called the Study Circles Resource Center. It's now called Everyday Democracy, but it's been one of the organizations that's been quite pivotal in helping to assist and grow this kind of public engagement work, mainly at the local level around the country. So I went from the theoretical side of things, the big questions about democracy, to the very specific challenges of how do you get people to participate on a rainy Tuesday evening to talk with perfect strangers about some kind of uncomfortable topic. And I've always enjoyed both sides of that equation, of both the big ideas and also the real practical realities of how you get this done.
Matt, you are the executive director of the Deliberative Democracy Consortium. Could you tell us more about its mission and how it seeks to promote and institutionalize deliberative democracy at all levels of government?
It's an alliance of nonprofit practitioner organizations like Everyday Democracy, America Speaks, the National Civic League, Public Agenda, the Kettering Foundation, a number of others like that, and also academics who are interested in or are in fact out there researching and writing about engagement. So it was created in order to kind of, first of all, to overcome that divide between the people who are practicing this kind of work in communities and also people who are studying it. And it was also created, the consortium, to kind of bridge the divide between that relatively small set of people who have some kind of expertise or have been thinking about or doing this public engagement work, and then many people out there in communities in particular who are actually doing it as part of their jobs in local government or in school systems or increasingly now state and federal agencies or other kinds of groups like that.
I think it's critical, Matt, to properly distinguish social media and collaboration and these platforms with the fact that public engagement work has been around well before the advent of the web. But I'd like to know, how has the advance of social media and other collaborative tools changed the work you do?
Well, there's a number of ways to answer that. The biggest answer, I think, is just that the internet has been part of this huge shift in what citizens know and can do. And that's probably the biggest thing to understand from a public manager's perspective about the changing terrain for all of this kind of stuff, is that simply that you're dealing with people who have different expectations and different capacities than they did 20 years ago or 50 years ago or whatever. And the internet is a big part of that shift, that basically, even though people have less and less time to devote to public life, that they have more skills and capacities to bring to the table. Even though they are pessimistic about what government can do for them, they have a kind of stronger sense of entitlement about some of those kinds of things. That in many ways, even though they're less aware of what's happening in their neighborhood or their community, when they kind of find an issue that they really care about, they're better able to find the allies, the resources that they need to actually make an impact on it. And the internet has been integral to all of those aspects of the shift. And one way of kind of just putting it all together to say that people are better at governing and less willing to be governed than ever before. And that poses all kinds of challenges and opportunities for people who are in public service, no matter what level of government you're dealing with.
Matt, your report is a cogent introduction, a how-to manual, really, outlining the best tools and tactics for effective public engagement. How do you want your audience, our readers, to use your report?
Well, I think I'm hoping that the introductory piece will give them some of the basic kind of information they need to kind of get started to start thinking about this. And most importantly, I think I hope that piece of it really drives home the need to have a longer-term kind of strategy or plan. I think a lot of us are, we're driven, of course, by kind of short-term needs, crises, opportunities like that. But we also have, especially when it comes to engagement, it really pays off to have a longer kind of strategy with other partners to figure out how you're going to have a relationship with your constituents. Then the tools piece, I'm hoping that the way in which the different scenarios are laid out will help people figure out in any particular situation or a particular kind of need they have, which are the online tools that might best fit as part of that kind of a longer-term kind of strategy, and which things might be most helpful for responding to more immediate kinds of needs.
What does it mean to engage the public in a wired world? We will explore this question and so much more when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns. What are the seven management imperatives all government executives need to know? How is DoD improving its business operations? What is FAA's next generation air transportation system, or NextJet? How is New York City shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And what about power, security, and leadership in the 21st century? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas to improving government effectiveness. My guest today is Matt Leininger, author of the IBM Center Report, Using Online Tools to Engage and Be Engaged by the Public. Matt, your report mentions that before selecting the best way to communicate with business, one needs to understand certain conditions. And in particular, defining the term public seems most challenging for public managers today. Would you elaborate on that perspective?
Well, the most basic thing here is simply that the biggest task in public engagement is often something that just doesn't get done at all, particularly by governments. And that biggest task is recruitment. A lot of governments are still in the kind of the frame of mind of, if we just kind of schedule the meeting, announce it in the general way that we always announce things, that the right people will show up. Even though most people, I think if you really ask them to think about it, would agree that the right people tend not to show up, that they tend to get either a very small crowd of people who are already highly involved in the issue, or they get if there's a controversy, they get a huge crowd of people who are already quite angry about what's happening. So it's that recruitment that often does not get done, but which can be done. I mean, there's no secret about how to do it. I mean, it's a pretty, you know, proven set of practices that can be used of figuring out who's in the constituency you're trying to reach, what kinds of networks or groupings that they belong to, reaching out to leaders within those networks to get them to recruit people that they already know and trust. So it's no secret about how to do it. It is a time-consuming piece, and it's something that often just doesn't happen.
Matt, what does it mean to engage the public in a wired world? And more particularly, would you elaborate on the key challenges and opportunities facing public managers who are using online tools to engage and be engaged by the public?
Well, there's a number of them. First of all, that in terms of challenges, that whether you plan for it or not, that engagement is going to happen. In fact, a quote I really like is from a guy who's a public administration professor, but also a former mayor of Lawrence, Kansas, a guy named John Nalbandian. He says that what drove me to try more structured, planned forms of public engagement was my intense frustration with unplanned, unstructured engagement. All kinds of people who are in public service, I'm sure, have kind of lived through this whole dynamic many times, is that, you know, people come out of the woodwork often at the least opportune time to give all kinds of input that you can't necessarily incorporate into whatever public decision or plan you're trying to create. So that bad dynamic, and especially also the kind of the use of fairly traditional formats for public engagement, public hearings, poorly structured town hall meetings, some of these things kind of in the law or in the process, the official process by which governments make decisions, and which are often not very helpful at all as far as actually kind of handling some of the input that you receive or trying to tap into some of the potential of it. On the more positive side, I mean, I think the opportunities are there, of course, also because of that great capacity or greater capacity that citizens bring to the table. If you do it right, you can not only get, you know, a lot of really interesting, helpful, smart input on what you're trying to do as a government, but you can also provide opportunities for people actually to put their money where their mouth is and to actually be part of some of those kinds of problem-solving efforts, figuring out what they can be doing as volunteers, as members of organizations, as a community, as a kind of a larger body politic to do something about the challenges that you're facing.
Matt, your report points out that public managers should keep in mind that short-term thinking and tools cannot replace the careful, collaborative planning and building of a long-term engagement infrastructure. I want to understand, what are the two core items public managers need to know in order to be successful in this area?
Well, I think the first piece is to reach out to other, well, I guess the first piece is, in fact, to have a longer-term kind of strategy, to think about engagement and what you're planning to do when it's not, you know, in the throes of a crisis or an immediate need to make a decision, to have a kind of a more of a long-term vision for what you want your relationship with citizens to be. And then the second piece is to actually then, based on some of that kind of thinking, to create some kind of a plan, working with allies outside government and or in other parts of government, in addition to working within your own particular office. To have that kind of partnership is really tremendously helpful when it comes to recruitment, when it comes to kind of ensuring that you got a range of perspectives that get into the process, and in a number of other ways.
One of the most common mistakes in online and face-to-face engagement is a failure to proactively recruit participants. The phrase, "if you build it, they will come," definitely does not apply to social media. Would you outline the key recruitment strategies that some of the most successful engagement initiatives tend to employ?
Well, again, it's what's happening. The successful thing seems to be to take kind of the best practices and simply apply them in the new, in kind of an online environment. And so, again, it's figuring out what kinds of networks people belong to, where are they going, what kinds of technologies are they using to connect, and kind of mapping out where they are and then figuring out within those different networks how you can kind of infiltrate them and get people to kind of recommend or recruit people they already know. The great thing about the online world is that that can happen much more quickly than it can in the old face-to-face or by telephone kind of world. I mean, it is true that things can go viral, and if you can kind of tap into the right combination of people, that recruitment can be done more easily, or at least more quickly than it has been done kind of in the past. On the other hand, it's also true that recruitment still needs to happen. You still need to have that kind of strategy. You still need to, you know, put a lot of upfront thinking and work into it, because there are a lot of kind of online ghost towns, you know, things set up by government agencies or other groups where they intended to kind of have lots of participation, and instead they have almost nothing. So a nice quote that I heard from somebody is that the phrase, you know, if you build it, they will come, does not apply to online work.
Matt, I'd like to switch gears a little bit. When public managers are using an online engagement tool as part of their one-time, time-limited initiative, you identified a number of ways that they can use the lessons and momentum of their work and their planning for a long-term engagement infrastructure. I really wish you would elaborate on this.
Well, one very basic thing, which doesn't happen enough, is simply to kind of document what you're doing. You know, writing up, even in a very basic way, that I think just helps you kind of learn from it, and of course helps other people learn from it who are trying to do something similar on to the future. Another piece is going kind of further from that and having more of a comprehensive kind of an evaluation off, and then working with an academic partner or some other kind of researcher to actually do something that's going to help you learn much more intensively from it. And then with the online work, there's a bunch of different tools that can be used in various ways that can then be used again and again. So, for example, if you're doing using wikis, and by the way, Inez Mergel's excellent report is also coming out around the same time here from the IBM Center, and it's all about using wikis within governance. So a wiki or crowdsourcing tools or sometimes the polling tools like SurveyMonkey and things like that, if you have used them kind of once in the course of a project like this, it's not so difficult then to kind of include them in a more kind of ongoing way in work that you're doing, so that you're allowing people who work for your organization or citizens themselves to actually kind of give some feedback about some of the kinds of things you're doing.
Matt, much of the legal framework for citizen participation predates the rise of social media and other online technologies. There are now several major questions confronting public managers as they begin to increase their use of new tactics and tools. Would you give us an overview of some of the legal framework issues facing public managers in this area?
Well, it's unfortunately still a kind of a very kind of unsettled environment, because, as you say, the legal framework for participation, and not simply online participation, but in general, the legal framework for citizen participation has not reflected what we know to work about engagement generally in the last 10 years or so. Most of the laws are older than that and don't kind of encompass the kind of the best practices. Some of the kind of the kind of cutting edges of that, I mean, in terms of geolocation tools, where you're using the capacity of kind of cell phones to identify where people are at any given time, that can be a terrific technology that can be very useful for in things like for Fix My Street or things that kind of allow people to tell government about a particular problem or something needs to be fixed in a particular location. So the laws around that, about whether, you know, that data can be collected by government, are kind of still waiting to be written. So in that area and in a bunch of other places, you really just have to kind of proceed with some forethought about those kinds of issues, proceed including kind of the legal experts you have on hand to help you figure out what the best way to go. But not to be too terribly cautious. I think, you know, Inez Mergel put it well when she said that people are just sometimes so afraid of doing anything online that they fail to do anything at all. Can't kind of stop, but neither can you just simply go ahead and do whatever you want to do without asking anybody who has some kind of legal expertise.
What are the 10 most effective tactics for engaging the public? We will explore this question and so much more when our special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns. This is The Center This Week, highlighting the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness, brought to you by the IBM Center for the Business of Government. I'm Michael Keegan, Managing Editor of the Business of Government magazine. The Center This Week is our opportunity to inform and, most importantly, to invite you, our listeners, to use the IBM Center for the Business of Government as your resource, a how-to resource for improving government effectiveness at the state, local, and federal level. Joining us today is John Kaminsky, Senior Fellow at the IBM Center for the Business of Government and author of A Challenge to the Performance Community. John, welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
John, could you tell us more about this stealth revolution?
Well, Michael, early last year, Professor Don Kettle, who's the dean of the Public Administration School at the University of Maryland, noted that the Obama administration seemed to be significantly reshaping the way the federal government governs itself and the way it manages performance. And he calls this stealth revolution. It's called stealth in part because there's not a name for this. It's not some big initiative that's being run across the government. But there's a lot of things that are going on. For example, just since the beginning of this year, the president signed a new law called the Government Performance and Results Act Modernization Act, which updates a performance law from 18 years ago. It's going to have major implications across agencies. Another is that in his State of the Union, he committed to reorganizing the government. The initial proposal is supposed to come out in early June. There was a presidential directive to expand the flexibility of administrative processes, and agencies have several months before they have to deliver plans back to the White House as to how they're going to provide greater flexibility to grantees and to small businesses and stuff. Another directive came out of the White House from the president to streamline service delivery and improve customer service. All these things, when you take them together, are having a major impact on how agencies are governing themselves. And the performance community, the group of people in agencies that are responsible for improving the performance or managing the performance of the government are in the middle of this. And this includes agency leaders, the strategic planners, the performance measurement experts, the performance improvement officers, the budget officers. So there's this cadre of people in every agency that are going to be heavily affected in the way they do their jobs by all these initiatives, which are what Kettle calls this stealth revolution.
John, what are the three elements of the Obama administration's performance agenda?
When President Obama took office, he had, during the campaign, committed to designating somebody as a chief performance officer. And that person that he appointed is a fellow by the name of Jeff Zients. He's from the private sector. And he serves in the role of chief performance officer for the whole government. And he's leading a lot of these initiatives that I just mentioned a little earlier. But he's also the deputy director for management in the Office of Management and Budget. And in that role, he's responsible for the stewardship and the capacity of the administrative systems across the government. He's the intersection point or the zenith of all the performance stuff that goes on in the government. So those two roles naturally intersect, and all these initiatives that I mentioned earlier are the responsibility of that person to implement. And what he's done to help frame all this is he says that there are three key things that he wants to do. One is he wants the government to focus on high priority performance goals. And he's asked agencies shortly after he took office to identify a small handful. And when you add them up across the government, there's about 125 of them from all the different agencies. And what they want to do is, rather than just making commitments, he says these are things that should be accomplished within 18 to 24 months by the people that are here. And he wants is for them to have regular quarterly reviews that are data-driven with public dashboards so people can track the progress of what's going on. And this is sort of inspired by what's been going on in states and cities around the country. For example, the Baltimore City Stat and the Washington State process. And this tracking process and bringing people together to look at the progress that's being made and what kind of adjustments need to be made in the process is going to be something that every agency is doing. In fact, this new law that I mentioned earlier puts this process that Zients proposed a year or so ago into statute. And so this June 30th, every agency will have had to have taken their high priority goals and put them through this kind of a process. And it's going to be displayed in government wide on a new website called performance.gov, where every agency's progress against each of these 125 or so goals will be displayed. Now, the other thing is, in addition to setting goals and tracking progress, is he says it's really important that we provide the tools or the ability of people from different agencies to learn from each other. So what he wants to do is create a series of problem-solving networks. And so some of these networks will be mission-related, like agencies that would be involved in reducing obesity in the general population. And so that would be from agriculture and Food and Drug Administration and other agencies. And some of these problem-solving networks will be process-based. For example, there will be a process-based network around improving service delivery and improving customer service. And the government-wide hub for a lot of these different initiatives will likely be the Performance Improvement Council, which was, again, in this new law that I mentioned, a new function that, again, Zients will be responsible for, and they'll sort of be the hub for all the performance management related networks. And the General Services Administration is building a government-wide web platform to allow cross-agency collaboration and being able to exchange information and share stuff, sort of like a government version of Facebook or something like that.
This has been The Center This Week with our guest John Kaminsky, Senior Fellow at the IBM Center for the Business of Government. More information on this and other Center resources is available at businessofgovernment.org. There you will find how the business of government is not business as usual. For the IBM Center for the Business of Government, I'm Michael Keegan, and this has been The Center This Week. What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen? How is the U.S. Department of Homeland Security turning its one DHS vision into a reality? What is New York City doing to shape a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And how is the DoD improving its business operations? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Hear from FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, DHS Undersecretary for Management Raphael Boris, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations Stephen Goldsmith, and Dave Winogrand, Assistant Deputy Chief Management Officer at DoD. Professor Joseph Nye and General Anthony Zinni on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century, and seven management imperatives that government leaders should pursue to be successful in an era of fiscal constraint. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas to improving government effectiveness. My guest today is Matt Leininger, author of The IBM Center Report, Using Online Tools to Engage and Be Engaged by the Public. Matt, your report for the IBM Center identifies five common scenarios or situations where public managers seek public engagement. I'd like for you to identify those five.
Sure. So going through the five scenarios then, and by the way, these, as you will probably understand quite quickly, these are often kind of woven together. You're often facing something that's a combination of factors. But the first scenario that we structure the guide around is scenario when you want to know the immediate citizen reactions to some kind of particular well-known issue or decision. You need kind of people's off the cuff. You need to kind of check their pulse on a particular issue or decision or a policy that you're dealing with. Scenario two is when you're in the midst of a more kind of a high-profile situation where it can be a crisis or it could be at least a situation where public opinion is fairly well formed, where people have kind of lined up on one side or another of an issue, or at least some of the organizations have lined up. Whether or not the citizens are kind of following is often an open question. But there seems to be some kind of level of heat or controversy around the situation. So that's scenario two. Scenario three is just when you're trying to get some new ideas and generally, you know, more information from people in order to make government more effective and more efficient. So you just want to know their ideas about new things to propose, new projects, new ways of solving particular problems, or you might be asking for very specific kinds of feedback about what's out there. So for example, you know, potholes or graffiti or things like that, where you know that citizens are experiencing some of these things every day, and you can use online tools to have them report to you, you know, which are the most difficult kinds of problems you need to solve. Scenario four is a situation where you're trying to not just have government be the problem solver, but to actually kind of encourage other citizens and other organizations to be part of the problem solving. So that in this kind of scenario, what you're trying to do is to encourage people to take some kind of shared ownership of the issue or the opportunity and devote some of their own time and energy to addressing it. And then the fifth thing is perhaps the most basic. It's simply where you're trying to educate citizens about a particular issue or decision, so that you're just trying to get some of the baseline information and some of the kind of key trade-offs they need to be thinking about out there on a particular area.
Matt, I'd like to delve into each one of these scenarios. And the first common scenario you identify in the report is public managers who want to know the immediate citizen reaction to a particular issue or decision. Would you elaborate on key factors to consider under this scenario? Is it important to include a face-to-face element? And what tactics and tools are most relevant for public managers facing scenario one?
I think this one, scenario one, is when you just need to know kind of the immediate citizen reactions to a particular issue. That's probably what the one where face-to-face kinds of interaction are least important, that you can get the pulse of the constituency purely online. And the two kind of main ways of doing that are surveys, which are quite easy now to kind of just create and to get out onto the internet, and then aggregation. Let me talk about that in a second. The surveys, the biggest question with surveys is, of course, whether or not you need a real random selection process. I mean, in some situations and some issues, you may just want to kind of not worry so much about who's responding to the survey, but in fact, just kind of get out there and get some kind of off-the-cuff opinions. In other situations, you really want a more scientific kind of sense of who's responding and to kind of get a more demographically representative set of people so that you can have a little bit more certainty about the data that you're going to get. The aggregation side, aggregation is a relatively new idea. It's basically there are new types of software which will essentially kind of trawl through social media using some kind of keywords or phrases that you give the program, and will find instances of where those words or phrases are being used in blogs or in other kinds of social media, on Twitter or on Facebook, and to try to kind of extract some kind of basic sense for you about how people are using those terms, how positively they're viewing them, things like that. Now, this is a very kind of new and evolving kind of type of technology. It's not clear quite where it's going to go yet, and you can imagine that it's not, unlike kind of a random selection surveys, the aggregation is always going to be, I think, less scientific as far as how you're getting the data. You're not going to be as sure about who's saying these things or how representative they are of the broader public, but you would get a sense of kind of the kinds of things that they're saying about the issue.
Matt, the second common scenario you've identified is creating consensus. A public manager in the midst of a high-profile situation in which different sets of people do not agree about what should be done. I want to get a sense of whether or not, much like the gathering of opinion, whether there's a face-to-face element in this scenario. What's the difference, really, between gathering opinion and creating consensus? And what are some of the tactics and tools that would be most effective for managers facing this scenario?
It's easy for citizens to have opinions about issues. It's harder to actually give them an opportunity to talk to one another and to actually have them kind of consider more carefully what they think and also figuring out how they're going to kind of act on it. And this is certainly one where face-to-face interaction can be really, really helpful to give people a chance to get together, kind of hear from one another, especially if you can get them together across some of these different lines, people who have different opinions or different ideas about a particular issue. If you can have them be in the same room in a group of about 10 or so to actually talk about why they care about the issue, absorb some of the information about the issue, look at a range of different options about it, and figure about kind of what common ground they might have, what recommendations they might make. That kind of process has proven to be very successful as a way of engaging citizens, and it really can, when it's done well, really take the heat off of public officials and other people working in government, because it's not simply the government having to kind of respond to contradictory kind of requests or demands from citizens. You're actually getting those citizens to talk to each other about what they might want and figuring out what they have in common. So that's, as I say, quite a proven tactic with face-to-face engagement. There are many processes which are trying to replicate or have replicated some of that kind of discussion online, but as you might imagine, there's some kind of ways in which that's more difficult if you're not in the same room with people. It's more convenient, I think, to do it online in many ways, but it kind of lacks some of the emotional and kind of intellectual power of having people be in the same room. Well, I think San Jose, the project that they put together, and this is in fact something that's evolved out of our longer term kind of face-to-face process called the Strong Neighborhoods Initiative, but as part of a kind of a more intensive kind of planning process, they got a whole lot of people involved online using something called Wiki Planning to think about kind of the future of their different neighborhoods in the city and how they wanted a government to be kind of responding to various needs and opportunities. And so it was a combination of the online experience where they got about 4,500 people during the course of the project and about 600 people then also in face-to-face meetings. The combination of the two things seems to really work well because you then have a larger number of people and also a real depth of kind of conversation so that you can get some really good feedback from people.
The third common scenario you identify in your report involves needing new ideas and more information from citizens to help make government more effective and or efficient. Would you give us a sense of some of the elements associated with Scenario 3, whether there's a face-to-face element involved, and what are some of the relevant tactics and tools that can be applied when one faces this kind of a scenario?
Well, Scenario 3 is where you're trying to just get new ideas or more information from citizens to help make government more effective and more efficient. So what you're trying to do is kind of just you put a call out to all kinds of people to figure out kind of, you know, what they have to suggest about a particular issue. Crowdsourcing is one term for, you know, a common way of doing that, basically where you are kind of creating a kind of an online environment where people can log in, can say, you know, here's my idea about how to do a particular, solve a particular problem or implement a new project, something like that. One thing that you'll get in that kind of setting is a real variety of you know, two-line things all the way up to extremely complicated, very sophisticated ideas that people have about a new project or a new way of solving a particular problem. So you've got to kind of be ready for that diversity of different kinds of things. Another thing that crowdsourcing can do is it basically allows you to, if you want, to kind of cast a worldwide net for things. I mean, you may be working in a particular community, but it doesn't mean that you can't be asking people anywhere in the world to suggest some ideas that you might use. That's obviously a unique power of online work, which is really pretty exciting.
Matt, scenario number 4 tries to engage citizens to take a shared ownership of an issue and participate in addressing it. Would you give us a sense of whether or not there's a face-to-face element in this area? Explain a little bit about this scenario and what relevant tactics would be helpful for a public manager who finds themselves faced with this scenario.
Yeah, this is another one where face-to-face work can be really helpful, more so than in the one with Scenario 3 we were just talking about. But in this situation, again, some of the power that you can kind of tap into is through kind of assembling people in small groups and giving them a chance to kind of talk about, you know, whatever their idea is or whatever the problem is they're focusing on, and give them some kind of more kind of established structure where they can kind of go through a series of steps to kind of think about what is their problem, what are the different assets they might have, or that they can identify that might be helpful for solving it, and then figure out some kind of plan where they can actually, you know, put those two things together and make some recommendations or tap into some resources to help them to figure out how to make it happen. One of the keys for that work is not only to kind of give people both online and face-to-face opportunities to kind of to communicate, but also to give them kind of support and encouragement from the outside, you know, giving them, announcing that there'll be some date at which or a meeting at which some of these different ideas or problem-solving efforts are going to be revealed or, you know, honored for their contributions. You know, if people have a deadline like that, if they know that in some way that the kind of the community is watching them or the world is watching them in some sense, that certainly kind of helps motivate them and gives them more kind of more steam for moving forward.
Matt, the fifth and final common scenario identified in your report is trying to educate citizens about a particular issue or decision. Would you elaborate on this particular scenario? What are the relevant topics you find most useful for public managers who may find themselves on the front line facing this scenario?
Well, this one is perhaps the most deceptive one and maybe the most common one, because all the time I think people in government are trying to figure out how they can inform or educate citizens about various different issues or policies. And the trick is that simply broadcasting that information is seldom enough these days, you know, partly because, you know, we're all bombarded with so much information all the time that it's quite likely that you never hit them with whatever piece of information you're trying to get them with. I know it's true from a research point of view. It's true that people tend to learn better when they have opportunities to interact or talk about the information, and also when they have opportunities to kind of visualize what it means. So therefore, yes, kind of face-to-face kinds of opportunities, in addition to kind of more interactive kinds of online exchanges, can be really helpful for helping people actually learn. And that can be much more helpful than simply trying to broadcast information to them. And then also some of the other kinds of online tools, like tools that allow people to kind of visualize, you know, land use options like Community Viz, or tools which allow them to kind of try to see a budget and to kind of play around with the elements of a budget and subtracting things here or adding things there, figuring out how that kind of affects the bottom line. Those kinds of tools, which are really handy online, can be helpful as far as helping people learn.
What does the future hold for engaging the public? We will explore this question and so much more when our special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns. Each edition of the Business of Government magazine has as its focus the core mission of the IBM Center, connecting research to practice as a means to improve public management. We do this by bringing together insights and perspectives blended with an equal measure of practicality and reflection from an array of government leaders, public managers, thinkers, and practitioners. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. In an era of fiscal contraction, today's leaders face unique challenges that present many difficult choices. It is a period that, while imposing many constraints, simultaneously confers as many opportunities to make a difference, introduce new ways of managing, explore pragmatic approaches, and pursue management imperatives that help government leaders perform in an ever-challenging, complex environment. In our latest edition, we bring you conversations with FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, outlining the Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen. Rafael Boris, DHS Undersecretary for Management, discusses how the department is turning its one DHS vision into a reality. Stephen Goldsmith, Deputy Mayor for Operations for the City of New York, discusses how the city is shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and efficient. We offer perspectives on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century from Professor Joseph S. Nye, Jr. and General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command. Our forum presents seven management imperatives that government leaders must pursue to be successful in this new environment. All of this and so much more in the Spring-Summer 2011 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas to improving government effectiveness. My guest today is Matt Leininger, author of the IBM Center Report, Using Online Tools to Engage and Be Engaged by the Public. Matt, your report identifies 10 tactics most commonly used to foster an engagement with the public, matching up scenarios with the tactics and online tools that seem most appropriate in a given situation. Would you elaborate on the first tactic, which is developing documents collaboratively using wikis? Would you tell us about the tactic, how it's used, what it offers, and any specific limitations associated with it?
Sure. And the kind of overall thing to kind of keep in mind here is that you're usually going to need kind of more than one of these things. So usually what you've got in any given kind of engagement situation, you've usually got more than one goal, and you also have to kind of be cognizant of what the people you're trying to engage and what their goals might be. So these things tend to be more holistic, more well-rounded, or at least more successful when they're more well-rounded. So it's often the case that no single one of these is going to be enough, but that a combination of a couple or several of them might be very helpful. So the first thing is kind of using wikis, and some people may have some experience with wikis, but basically what a wiki is a document that people can log in and see and then make changes to and to edit over time. And the way that the technology works is to kind of keep track of who made what change when, so that you've got a sense of an evolving document. And it's a way of kind of doing joint editing for something in a way that's very transparent and allows a whole bunch of people to kind of be part of the process. So it's great for situations where you're trying to actually create a document, you know, a plan for the agency or for the community or for a particular issue area, and it's something that will kind of not require as much staff. And one of the kind of the virtues of it is that, you know, unlike doing this in a offline world, the staff time is far reduced when you're actually being able to do it with this kind of more automatic kind of technology. Well, one thing, and this is true of a lot of these online technologies, is it's got to be something that will kind of reach out to people to some extent. So it's got to get into their email inboxes, basically. That if you simply kind of set up a site or a wiki or anything else like that and ask people to continue to come back to it again and again, they generally aren't going to do that. Their participation is going to wane far more quickly. Whereas if it's something that's set up so that any change to the document for in a wiki, for example, actually that's kind of they're being notified on some kind of regular basis that this document is evolving, and then that gives them kind of the prompt to go from their email to the document and see what's happening. It's a kind of a general principle for all of these kinds of things is setting up a kind of a standalone site is never enough. It's got to be something that kind of actually gets to people. It's more kind of nudges them along the way.
As a follow-up, would you describe an example of the tactic in use today?
Well, the San Jose one, actually, that was probably the best one. There's actually a national one in New Zealand, though, that was really interesting, where they actually revised the Police Act, which had been in force for 50 years, and they invited people to kind of actually collaboratively rewrite the Police Act for the country, using the kind of the original law first and then allowing people to edit it as they went. It was something that actually was at least 4 million people actually checked in at some point in the process of kind of rewriting this law for New Zealand.
Matt, your second tactic is creating shared workspace for citizens. What does this mean, and could you give us an example of this tactic in use today?
Sure. Well, basically, it's giving people some structure to surround their efforts. So if you've got a set of people, a small committee of some kind, a task force that are kind of determined to work on a particular issue, you're kind of giving them kind of an online kind of workspace where they can kind of regularly interact, can kind of find more information, that can kind of stay connected. Some of the basic kind of forms of these, things like Google Groups, which people are Ning, those are two very common ones that a lot of people have some experience with. Some of the newer ones, which are really more focused on kind of public engagement needs, are things like civicevolution.org, which is a really nice one that kind of blends in a number of different media. One example of this, where civic evolution actually was used, is in Australia, actually, where they created a whole bunch of teams of people to work on different kind of problem-solving ideas for this city of Geraldton Green, which is in the western part of Australia.
Matt, another tactic I found interesting calls for the use of quote-unquote serious games to generate interest, understanding, and input. What do you mean by serious games? And would you tell us a little bit about the tactic, what it offers, its specific limitations, and any examples of its use in place today?
Well, one thing that I like about this one is that it gets to one of the real opportunities of this kind of work, which is to make it fun. I mean, I think one of the mistakes we've made is to treat all this political stuff as always being completely dry and sober and dreary, and that in fact, the more that you can kind of mix in different aspects of fun, you know, socializing, music, food, or in this case, games, the better off you is, the more participation you're going to get and the more enthusiasm you'll get from people. In this one, you know, the idea is to kind of create something that is fun to use that will give people more information about an issue or allow them to kind of give input in a way that they might not before. So there's a number of versions of budget games of one kind or another. There's one in Maryland called the Maryland Budget Game, which is put together by the Maryland Budget and Tax Policy Institute and the University of Baltimore. But there's a number of others like this where basically the game is to figure out how you can actually balance the budget in creative ways, and what the game allows you to do is to see what different things cost and see the effects of revenue raising options or budget cuts and how that kind of influences both the short term and the long term kind of budget balance.
Matt, serving citizens is tactic 5. It seems self-explanatory, but would you tell us more about it?
Serving citizens, I mean, there's some kind of very easy to use free tools out there that, you know, public managers can take a look at. One is SurveyMonkey.com, SurveyConsole.com, SurveyGizmo.com, and you'll see, I think, that many of these things are very, very easy to kind of customize to use in different kinds of settings. In terms of aggregation, aggregating opinions, as I said before, is probably the newest and most quickly evolving kind of technology. The White House has used it somewhat with a tool called ThinkUp, which tries to track some of the ripples on Twitter and Facebook and other kinds of social media sites that kind of have some kind of themes or keywords in common with the kind of policies that the administration is working on. But again, aggregation is something that's quite new, and I think it's going to be evolving a lot over the next couple of years.
Matt, I'd like to talk about Tactic 7, the ranking and identifying of ideas and solutions. Could you tell us a little bit about it, what it offers those who use it, and what are some of the limitations and possible examples of this tactic in use today?
Sure. So this basically is, when you hear the term crowdsourcing, this is the kind of thing that people are talking about. And basically, some kind of a site which allows people to propose ideas or solutions to a particular issue. And then often what's part of the technology as well is giving people a chance to kind of comment on them or vote on them so that you get not just a whole batch of ideas, but then you get the crowd to basically help you figure out which have the most potential or which are the most worth kind of a closer look. It certainly taps into quite easily a whole lot of skills and knowledge of people who are outside government, and not only in terms of kind of getting them to give their ideas, but also then giving them a chance to actually kind of scrutinize other people's ideas and see which ones they like and which ones they don't. And again, it's something you can cast quite a wide net, so you can get people from, you know, all over the world, in fact, to actually be part of this kind of process. Now, if you're not, like all the other kinds of tools we've been talking about here, if you're not kind of proactive about recruitment, you may not get a large crowd. So there's obviously recruitment work that has to happen in addition to simply kind of putting the site out there. And of course, if you want to have a relatively representative set of people kind of giving their ideas and prioritizing, that is also a big piece as far as the recruitment. You've got to figure out who you think are going to be less likely to participate and focus more of your recruitment time on those sets of people. Some agencies have kind of injected a little even more kind of fun into this. Like for example, Maynard, Texas, which has become kind of the poster child for crowdsourcing. What they do is they actually have created their own little virtual currency called InnoBucks. And so people, when they propose ideas or comment on other people's ideas or participate in other ways, they get a certain number of InnoBucks, and those things are then things that the InnoBucks they can redeem for, you know, various prizes, you know, gift certificate at a local restaurant or, you know, police department t-shirt or things like that. So again, it's something that kind of makes the whole process a little bit more fun than simply a dry kind of a thing. This whole idea, though, of crowdsourcing is, you know, one thing to kind of keep in mind is that if what you're doing is simply gathering new ideas and solutions from citizens, it's terrific, but there's no guarantee there that government is going to actually have the wherewithal to implement these things. So if you're doing something, a kind of a crowdsourcing initiative, you need to be thinking about that aspect and what is it that you can kind of bring into the process or include in the strategy that will actually get people to kind of commit some of their own time and energy and their organizations that they belong to actually implement these things rather than simply creating a much larger kind of laundry list for things that people want government to do.
Matt, Tactic 8 involves working with citizens to identify and prioritize problems that government can fix. Would you tell us a little bit more about this tactic, what it offers, some of its limitations, and possibly identify some of the best examples of its use today?
Well, the idea here is that you're using people to be kind of intelligent sensors of the world around them, basically tapping into the fact that people know about where the potholes are, where the graffiti is, or other kinds of water leaks, broken streetlights, litter, all kinds of things like that they know about, and kind of using the technology that's available now on most people's cell phones to actually give them a chance to quickly and immediately kind of report some of those kinds of problems to you so that you can figure out what to do. Some of these kinds of processes, in fact, also build in some kind of a prioritization kind of process so that people not only are reporting some of these kinds of problems, that they're also then looking at the site and figuring out which ones are more important than others so that you get a sense of, you know, what does the neighborhood think about which aspect of the streetscape need to be fixed first or things like that. By the way, some of the best examples of this are local examples like DC 311 in Washington, and then some of the worldwide ones like CClickFix, which is our OpenStreetMap, which work in lots of different communities. Again, there's kind of the same limitations with crowdsourcing, is that, you know, there's no guarantee that government is going to have the resources to fix all the problems or all the potholes or the graffiti that citizens want. So it's important to kind of think about that aspect of things, about how things are actually going to be implemented.
What about Tactic 9, helping citizens to visualize geographic data? Would you tell us a little bit more about it, what it offers, its limitations, and give us some examples of its use today?
Well, this is one that's neat, if particularly when people are dealing with kinds of land use kinds of decisions or planning, and you need to help them kind of visualize what they're talking about or what the different consequences might be of building something in a particular location or changing the way the streets are routed or things like that. And so there are kind of basic open source kinds of tools like Google Maps or Virtual Earth, which can be modified somewhat to help you do this. And then there's much more specific kinds of tools like CommunityViz.com or MetroQuest, which give people a chance to kind of modify it to their particular community. And there's a number of nonprofits and planning consultants which specialize in this kind of work. In New York City, there's actually a project called Envisioning Development, which includes a number of these kinds of tools, which gives people a chance to kind of figure out not only what the different kind of consequences of different land use decisions might be, but also to kind of match that against the city's uniform land use review procedure, which is what kind of guides how all those decisions get made.
Matt, the final tactic that you identify is helping citizens to balance budget and revenue options. First up, would you tell us a little bit about this tactic? What are some of the benefits and limitations, and where is it in use today?
These online tools are part of a really quickly emerging type of engagement called participatory budgeting, which started out actually in Latin America, in Brazil, and in other cities in South America in a really large way. And initially, it was all a face-to-face kind of a process. And in some of these cities, thousands of people are now part of an annual procedure where they get a chance to actually figure out what the local budget is going to look like for their city. More recently, some of those cities have included kind of online elements to that, those kinds of projects. And then in places like Chicago, the 49th Ward, and then in some cities in California, they're using both the kind of online tools, which give people a chance to see how different budget decisions will face, you know, change the bottom line. They use those in concert with kind of face-to-face meetings where people get together and talk about the kind of general priorities that they have for their neighborhood or their city and how those ought to be upheld in the budget.
Matt, your report does a wonderful job of identifying common sense scenarios that a lot of public managers and frontline folks will face, and it marries them up with important tactics and tools. It really makes for a nice how-to guide. What advice would you give frontline managers who are dealing with a lot of the public engagement initiatives that are around open government and transparency?
Well, one thing is you know, don't do it alone. You know, basically that this kind of work in particular, you're rewarded by reaching out to other allies to actually work with you on it. And this is something that is still quite uncommon in this kind of field. I mean, collaboration is increasingly common, I think, in lots of other types of policymaking. But in engagement, in my experience, local governments, agencies, all kinds of groups, they tend to kind of just focus on it in terms of their own particular needs and interests. And they don't think to actually collaborate with other groups who may have overlapping needs and interests. And that's, I think, a real opportunity lost. So thinking about how do you collaborate when you do engagement, I think, is a really important thing to keep in mind. And the second thing is to always be aware of the fact that this is a two-way street, that it's not just about your particular goals or needs and reaching out to the public. It's about what are their goals and needs as far as reaching out to you and kind of recognizing that relationship is part of what's going to have to be negotiated through the course of any kind of successful engagement effort. You got to be open to what citizens want, and they need to understand what you need and want as part of the whole process.
Matt, what does the future hold in this area?
I that's a big question. I think that a couple of things that seem likely, and I think they're quite positive. One is increasingly blurring the lines between and kind of interweaving face-to-face and online interaction as part of this engagement work. And then the other thing, I think, is to move beyond what we have tended to do, which is this very kind of temporary, crisis-based or issue-based type of engagement where people are kind of issue after issue, policy after policy, doing the same hard work of recruiting participants, designing the process, making it all work, to a more permanent, more ongoing kind of a structure where you don't have to do that recruitment work every time the same way, where you've got kind of more stable networks of people out there who you're connected to that are there, who are willing to kind of be talking about some of the issues or decisions that are on your plate, and that also have opportunities to tell you about some of the issues or concerns that they have. The greatest potential, I think, of social media is to create those kinds of networks of people that communities need, that agencies need, to be able to kind of have not just a series of one-off relationships with citizens around a particular issue or decision, but a more stable, long-term relationship, which can enable them to kind of do more of these different kinds of things that can be positive benefits of engagement.
That's a wonderful way to end the conversation, Matt. I want to thank you for your time today, but more importantly, I want to thank you for your recent IBM Center report, Using Online Tools to Engage and Be Engaged by the Public.
Thanks so much. It's been a great conversation.
This has been a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness with Matt Leininger, author of the IBM Center report, Using Online Tools to Engage and Be Engaged by the Public. You may order or download a free copy of this IBM Center report at businessofgovernment.org. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
Join host Michael Keegan next week for the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. How do we lead in an era of complex challenges? How is DOD changing the way it does business? What does USDA do to promote agricultural exports? And how can the U.S. be more competitive? Tune in to the Business of Government magazine next week and find out.